It's time to tell our side of the story, but we need your help. Please share, like, and subscribe to this podcast wherever you're listening to it. And please, don't forget to give us a 5-star rating. It helps us beat the big tech algorithm. Also, if you love Red Pilled America, please consider becoming a Backstage subscriber. For as little as $5 a month, you'll have access to our entire back catalog of episodes and our behind-the-scenes podcast. Just visit redpilledamerica.com and click support in the top menu. That's redpilledamerica.com and click support in the top menu. Support what you love or it goes away.
Previously on Red Pilled America.
The major enemy is the honky and his institutions of racism. That's the major enemy.
We want black power. We want black power.
The Black Panthers then took the bold move of attempting to enter the Capitol building with their firearms.
No more kids in our community.
The only politics in this country that's relevant to black people today is the politics of revolution.
The Black Panther Party poses a real threat to the peace and tranquility of the city of Oakland.
Bobby Hutton came out with his hands in the air and was gunned down.
The Black Lives Matter movement is everywhere. Where did it come from? And perhaps more importantly, what does it want? I'm Patrick Carolci.
And I'm Adriana Cortez.
And this is Red Pilled America, a storytelling show. This is not another talk show covering the day's news. We are all about telling stories.
Stories Hollywood doesn't want you to hear.
Stories the media mocks.
Stories about everyday Americans that the elites ignore.
You could think of Red Pilled America as audio documentaries, and we promise only one thing. The truth. Welcome to Red Pilled America.
Do you know that Red Pilled America is the only storytelling show of its kind? It's true. We are the only storytelling show that acts as an antidote to the Marxist indoctrination currently infecting every cultural institution in America. Film, literature, academia, art, music, television. We've been doing the show for close to 2 years, and the only reason we're still here is thanks to the support of our listeners. You are our lifeline. Without your support, we do not survive. Please consider supporting Red Pilled America by visiting our website at redpilledamerica.com and clicking support in the top right menu. You can make a one-time donation, purchase some of our Made in the USA merchandise, or maybe become a Backstage subscriber. For as little as $5 a month, you'll get access to our entire archive of episodes and our behind-the-scenes podcast. Support what you love, or it goes away.
So this is part 3 of Hands Up, our series of episodes delving into the origin of Black Lives Matter to figure out where it came from and what it wants. You don't need to have heard the last 2 episodes to understand this one, but in case you missed them, in part 1 we looked at how BLM came into national prominence by telling the story of the death of Michael Brown. In part 2, we dug into the true origin of BLM by telling the story of its predecessor, the Black Power Movement, a civil rights crusade that departed from Martin Luther King Jr. by advocating for a more aggressive, even violent approach. The movement was triggered by a Trinidad-born man named Stokely Carmichael, who argued that the white man generally, and the police specifically, were the enemy of black Americans. In June 1966, he introduced the phrase black power to a national audience and inspired young African Americans to fight, literally, for what they wanted. The new movement he triggered and the message of Malcolm X inspired 2 streetwise men in Oakland that wanted to target what they saw as police brutality. In October 1966, these 2 men, Huey P. Newton and Bobby Seale, launched the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense. They called law enforcement pigs and decided to arm themselves and shadow Oakland police during traffic stops. Cops were uncomfortable with their tactic, but couldn't stop them because according to California law, it was legal. So they successfully lobbied an Oakland legislator to propose a gun control bill to ban open carry in the Golden State. When the Black Panthers caught wind of the bill making its way through the California legislature, they took the bold step of protesting within the state capitol building with their loaded firearms. The bill eventually passed, but the Black Panthers' stunt was a media sensation, and it grew membership into the group quickly, too quickly, attracting an unvetted, violent militant element in the process. When Martin Luther King Jr. was killed, the Black Panthers executed an ill-conceived ambush of Oakland police. The group's first member, a 17-year-old black man named Bobby Hutton, was killed in the shootout. The Panthers privately blamed one of their own for his death, but publicly, they claimed Hutton was executed by racist cops while surrendering with his hands up. The hands up, don't shoot meme was born. By the early 70s, the FBI had systematically jailed, killed, or scared off many of the Black Power leaders, neutralizing the militant movement. But the damage to America was already done. The Black Power movement successfully seeded in the minds of America's black youth that the police were the enemy. So why did it take roughly 40 years for BLM to rise from the ashes of the Black Power movement? The answer was inadvertently given by one of the movement's early celebrity supporters.
Thank you. We just came from Bobby Hutton's funeral.
When speaking at a memorial for the Black Panthers' first member, Bobby Hutton, the young man whose death inspired the hands up, don't shoot tactic, Marlon Brando provided the key element missing in the Black Power movement.
That could have been my son lying there, and I'm going to do as much as I can. I'm going to start right now to inform white people of what they don't know. The Reverend said, the white man can't cool it because he's never dug it. And I'm here to try to dig it. But I myself as a white man have got a long way to go and a lot to learn. I haven't been in your place. I haven't suffered the way you've suffered. I'm just beginning to learn the nature of that experience. And somehow that has to be translated to the white community now. Time's running out for everybody.
The white man needed to be educated on the oppression of black America. And in the words of the Black Power movement, that oppression had been going on continually for 400 years. In other words, since the birth of slavery. By the time of Marlon Brando's speech in 1968, America's slavery past was not emphasized. U.S. history classes in K-12 public schools focused on the Pilgrims, the Founding Fathers, the American Revolution, things that built pride in our country. As for slavery, the topic was typically limited to how Abraham Lincoln freed them. The harshest aspects of this so-called peculiar institution were not discussed in great depth in the classroom. And well, neither was indentured servitude, Japanese concentration camps, or women's voting rights. In pop culture, the most brutal aspects of slavery were largely avoided as well. A few years after Brando's Black Panther moment, a sprinkling of movies came out that addressed the issue. There was Slaves starring Dionne Warwick in 1969 and Mandingo in 1975. But they were crappy films that didn't have mainstream appeal or success. The biggest pop culture event with slavery as a central theme was the 1939 movie Gone with the Wind, still the biggest box office hit of all time when adjusted for inflation. That said, Gone with the Wind positioned slavery as more or less a civilized relationship between blacks and white southerners.
Scarlett, I will not make money out of the enforced labor and misery of others.
You weren't so particular about owning slaves.
Well, that was different. We didn't treat them that way. Besides, I'd have freed them all when Father died, if the war hadn't already freed them.
Simply put, there was really no mainstream content that dealt with the darkest aspects of slavery. But that would all change in 1977.
Tonight, we present a landmark in television entertainment. Roots, the true story Alex Haley uncovered in his 12 years search across the seven generations of his ancestry.
Roots was a 12-hour miniseries telling the harrowing true story of the family of black American author Alex Haley. It was the first mainstream depiction of a specific African being enslaved and brought to America, and the brutal trials he and his ancestors faced before winning their freedom. By the end of its broadcast, Roots was the most watched TV drama in U.S. history and became an international sensation. And what Alex Haley did to find his roots was nothing short of unbelievable.
By the early 60s, one of the forefathers of the Black Power movement, Malcolm X, was beginning to receive national attention.
Once the police have convinced the white public that the so-called Negro community is a criminal element, they can go in and question, brutalize, murder unarmed, innocent Negroes. And the white public is gullible enough to back them up. This makes the Negro community a police state. This makes the Negro neighborhood a police state. It's the most heavily patrolled. It has more police in it than any other neighborhood, yet it has more crime in it than any other neighborhood. How can you have more cops and more crime? Why? It shows you that the cops must be in cahoots with the criminals.
A reformed criminal who joined the black nationalist group, the Nation of Islam, while in prison, Malcolm X was a 6'3", good-looking, red-haired African-American who advocated for violence if necessary in the fight for civil rights and believed black Americans needed to segregate from the white devil.
We are African, and we happen to be in America. We're not American. We are people who formerly were Africans who were kidnapped and brought to America.
By 1963, he could not be ignored, and Playboy assigned one of its up-and-coming writers, Alex Haley, to interview him for the magazine. Alex Haley was a 41-year-old black columnist from a prominent family in Tennessee that happened to be in the right place at the right time. His feature on Malcolm X led to a publisher offering the black nationalist a book deal. Malcolm X turned to Alex to help write it, and the two worked on the project for about 2 years. When they approached the finish line in early 1965, the duo held up in a hotel to bang out the final draft.
When the manuscript was finished, I went back down and worked with Malcolm. I was by now living upstate New York and worked with him in a hotel. And he went across from first page to last, making this or that editing change with his favorite ballpoint pen, and at the bottom of each page putting his MX. And then he said to me, "I don't think I'm going to live to read this in print." Malcolm proved to be very prophetic because it was less than 2 weeks later he was shot to death in the Audubon Ballroom.
On February 21, 1965, the fiery civil rights activist was killed by members of the Nation of Islam.
At about 3:15 p.m. This afternoon, there were about 400 persons present in the ballroom here. And Malcolm was addressing the audience from the speaker's platform when apparently, two men approached the speaker's rostrum and discharged shots at him from apparently very close range.
The following morning, Alex Haley worked feverishly to finish the book.
I sat down and began the most traumatic writing I have ever done in my life, calling forth as best I could reminiscings of having met and worked with this man, anecdotes and insights into him, put together in some kind of tumbling chronology. And that is that part which now appears at the end of that book called the epilogue. And the autobiography of Malcolm X was concluded and on its way into print.
The untimely death of Malcolm X was about to catapult the scribe of his autobiography. The book became a bestseller, and Alex Haley now had some leverage to seek another idea, the story of his ancestors' journey from captured slave in Africa to eventual freedom in America. The idea took root early in his life while sitting on a porch in the South. As a young boy, Alex Haley stayed with his grandmother in a small town called Henning, Tennessee, about an hour north of Memphis by car. He often spoke about that time in his later years.
Every summer, my grandmother, who was widowed, would invite to her home various women members of the family.
Reciting this childhood memory displayed his gift at storytelling.
And my earliest memories include that every single evening across those summers, after supper, as we call the evening meal, when the dishes had been washed, these ladies, who generally averaged about my grandmother's age range, late 40s, early 50s, would go out from the kitchen and kind of filter out onto the front porch. They would each take seats in cane bottom rocking chairs, and they would begin rocking back and forth. And they would talk each evening, unless there was some local gossip to supersede it temporarily. They would talk about the self same thing. It was a long narrative history of a family, although I didn't know that as a little boy. It was not a verbatim thing, but bits and pieces and patches which were told together kind of in a mixed, homogenized way about this family. They would speak about people, they would speak of places, speak of things, And I, as a little boy, didn't have the orientation to understand a great deal that they talk about. For instance, when they spoke of people and they talked about an old massa, I didn't know what an old massa was. I didn't know what an old missus was. When they spoke about places and they mentioned a plantation, I didn't know what that was, although after a while I began to get some impression it must be something rather like a farm from the things I heard being done on them.
Alex said he got the impression, even as a young boy, that these stories dug deep into the past.
When they were speaking of people, the furthest back person they ever would speak of was someone whom they called the African. They would tell how this African was brought on a ship to this country to a place which they pronounced as Naples. And they would tell how he was bought off that ship by a man whom they called Massa John Waller, who took this African to his plantation in a place which they described as Spotsylvania County, Virginia. And they told how there this African desperately kept trying to escape. The first three times he escaped, he was caught, brought back, and each time given a worse beating than previously as his punishment.
But it was the fourth time he was captured that was the most troubling.
He was given an exemplary punishment, or in fact, choice of punishments. It was told that he was given the choice before the others either of being castrated or of having a foot cut off. And this African chose the foot. The story was that his foot was put on a stump and with an axe was cut off across the arch. It was a hideous act. It was by no means a necessarily uncommon act in the course of antebellum slavery.
What underscored the brutality was how Alex described what happened as common. White slave owners frequently handicapped their black slaves permanently, their live-in workers. The story was absolutely heartbreaking and enraging. This African would eventually mate with another slave.
And of this union was born a little girl, and she was given the name Kizzy. As the little girl Kizzy grew up, it was said that when she got to be 4 or 5 or so and could begin to understand such things, this African father of hers, every chance he got, would take the little girl, his daughter, by the hand and lead her about the plantation. He would point out to her various natural objects, a tree, a rock, the sky, a cow, a chicken, anything of this nature. And every time he'd point out any such object to his daughter, he would tell her the name for that thing in his native tongue. And the little girl, Kizzy, like any child today hearing an alien tongue spoken, heard and learned strange phonetic sounds. Gradually, with repetitive hearing of them and repetition of them on her own part, she memorized these sounds and she came to associate certain sounds with certain objects.
Alex described how these words stayed with Kizzy, including her father's African name.
In the case of this African, he was given by his master the name Toby. But it was said that on that plantation that every time any of the other slaves would address him as Toby, he would strenuously rebuff and reject it and tell them that his name was Kinte. As a matter of fact, it would appear he had a passion for trying to communicate to his daughter a sense of his past. Among the stories he told her was how he had been captured. He said that he had been not far away from his village, chopping wood, intending to make himself a drum, when he had been surprised, set upon, overwhelmed, and thus had been kidnapped into slavery. And the little girl, Kizzy, came to know that story that her father told, among other stories that he told.
With the birth of a new child, Alex described how this family would gather in the slave quarters and tell the story of their ancestors going all the way back to Kizzy, her father Kinte, and the moment he was captured in Africa. And that tradition continued through 7 generations, tracing their journey from Africa to American slaves to freedom and all the way through the birth of a girl named Cynthia, who would eventually find herself repeating it on a rocking chair in Tennessee.
And as fate was further to have it, Cynthia was to become my maternal grandma. And I told you at the outset how I grew up in my grandma's home in Little Henning, Tennessee, and she pumped that story into me as if it were plasma. It was by all odds the most precious thing in her life, the story of the family which had come down across the generations in the manner I have described.
Alex said he heard this story repeated time and time again through his early teens, and it stayed with him. So after he finished the Malcolm X book, he began casually searching library archives, trying to gather bits of information about his family's past. According to Alex, he became obsessed with the search of his roots, but before he could go any further, he needed a refresher on the oral history of his ancestors. So he traveled to the last living relative that participated in those porchside tales, his cousin Georgia. The two met.
After the initial huggings and the kissings and the boy, you done growed up good, the minute that I told cousin Georgia, spoke to her about the story, she was off and running as if we'd been sitting on that front porch the previous afternoon. She said, yeah, boy, that African, he say his name was Kente. He called the guitar Cole. He called the river Cambi Bolongo. He say he was chopping wood for to make himself a drum when they cotched him, and all the rest of the story told in her own colorful way. It was like echoes from boyhood.
Now armed with a trace of his African ancestor, Kente, he reached out to an expert on African language and repeated the words and stories to him in hopes that they provided a clue to Kente's homeland. After some thought and a few calls, the expert said that Kente could have been from a specific area in the Gambia, a country in West Africa. And as luck would have it, the expert knew of a student from the area that was studying in America. The student agreed to bring Alex to the Gambia to help him search for any signs of exactly where this Kente was from. The two traveled to the capital city of the Gambia to meet the student's father, and the elder had apparently done some groundwork.
When he spoke with me, he got together three men whom he knew to be very knowledgeable of the history of the country, and I met with those men in the lounge of the Little Atlantic Hotel.
And what they told Alex was promising. Apparently, the people of the area had a unique way of recording African lineages.
They told me how history has been kept for centuries in Africa. They told me about the existence of very old men who are called griots. It's spelled G-R-I-O-T-S. As they described them, griots seem to be like walking, living archives. They told me of men who are in a line of griots. The senior griot would be about late 60s, early 70s. Beneath him would be men at about decade intervals younger, down to a teenage boy. And that the boy would grow on up, mature, hearing the story of a large family clan told over and again until he began to tell parts of it, and a little more, until that boy one day, hopefully, would be the senior griot, able to talk for sometimes in some big family cases as much as 2 days without once repeating himself, telling in the most meticulous detail, in great, great microscopic detail, the story of a clan over a period of century or more.
This was stunning information to Alex. He now had a potential pathway to finding the homeland of the African ancestor his family called Kente. The three men said they'd do some digging, and Alex returned to the States with one immediate goal. He contacted his former publisher and pitched the idea for a book, The Story of a Black Man's Search for His Roots in Africa. The publisher bit, agreeing to pay him a monthly stipend for a year to finance his research. Now Alex just needed to confirm everything his family had passed down through the generations, and most importantly, find the homeland of the African named Kente. Alex eventually heard back from one of the three men that he had met in the capital of the Gambia.
The same men with whom I had previously talked told me, matter-of-factly, that there was now found in a backcountry village an old griot knowledgeable of the Kente clan story.
The griot was from a remote village called Jufre on the west coast of Africa. So in 1967, Alex made the trek to the village. After a safari-like trek with an expedition team of 14, he arrived in Jufre and was immediately greeted by the villagers and the human archive known as the griot.
The old man, the griot, his name was Keba Kanga Fofana. He had 73 reigns, their way of saying 73 years of age. One reign a season a year. He began now to tell me the history of the Kente clan. He speaks, and the words are almost as if a scroll is being read. He would say two or three sentences, and the interpretation or translation would come to me. When I had heard a good fair amount of it, I was absolutely awed, immersed in just wonder that such could be, that out of this man's memory and his mouth was coming such an incredible array of lineage, all the way across a family line 100-odd years ago, who married whom, what children in what order, all the way across that line, then drop back down to the children themselves, each child whom they had married, their children in what order, all the way across. I was struck by the biblical way it was being expressed in the translations. And so took as a wife so and so, and begot, and begot, and begot. Now I heard this wizened old griot say through the interpreter, quote, about the time the king's soldiers came, the eldest of these four sons, Kunta, went away from this village to chop wood, and he was never seen again.
This was similar to the story that his family repeated on that porch throughout his childhood. An African named Kente went to gather wood to make a drum and was captured in the process, never to see his African family again.
Well, I sat there as if I was carved of rock. Goose pimples that felt to be the size of grapes all over me. There was no way in the world for that man to know what he had said to me.
Alex Haley had found the homeland of his African ancestor, Kente. He would spend the next 6 years corroborating the details of his family's stories, a story that spanned 7 generations all the way back to Africa. In the early 1970s, he began putting pen to paper, writing out a draft for the book. At one point, he had trouble describing what Kunta Kente must have experienced while being transported to America as a slave. He decided to do something drastic.
I was trying to get into a character, you know, to feel that character so much that in effect you become the character. And what it was, I was at the time living in San Francisco, and I was trying to write that part about this boy, 16, down in the hold of a slave ship with 139 other people, because the ship's cargo was 140 she left Africa with. And I would write 30, 40 pages and out it went. It just didn't grip. And you, a writer, know that before anybody else. You know it isn't right. And finally I realized I had no right, really, to be up in some high-rise carpeted apartment trying to write about him in that slave ship hold. So I flew to Africa, and I was able finally to book passage on a freighter coming from Liberia to the United States. And I got on it, and I made arrangements sort of that I could, after dinner each evening, I would go down in the second hold of the ship. And, you know, I don't know if you've been in freight as much. I was 20 years in the Coast Guard. I know, you know, a good deal about ships. But the holds of ships are deep, dark, cavernous, cold. And down in there, the cargo was bales of raw rubber. And I found a big, rough timber they used to put between the cargo to keep it from shifting in rough seas. And I would go down there and take off my clothing to my underwear and lie down on the plank on my back. And I would make myself stay there all night until in the morning I could hear footsteps on the steel deck overhead. And I did that crossing, and it was an effort to try and psych myself or put myself into some circumstance in which I could feel that I was he. And I could, you know, sort of work the five senses thing. What did he hear? What did he think? What did he see, smell, so forth? And that was how, finally, I was able to write that section.
It took him 3 years to finish writing Roots, and anticipation for the book was building. So much so that a TV producer bought up the rights to the story long before it was published. That producer, David L. Wolper, explained why at the time.
Well, I've always been interested personally in a generational story. I try to develop a story even before Roots about 4 Indian generations, and then I couldn't get it on. I try to develop one about 4 police generations in a family. I couldn't get that on. I try to develop one about a family of an automobile family, four generations in an automobile family. But somehow I guess the timing was right. And when Roots came along and I said, what a great idea, following a black family from Africa through all the turmoil of its life until today.
Alex Haley finally published his 912-page tome in October 1976. He titled it Roots, The Saga of an American Family, and it was an immediate sensation, largely because the book was so monumental. It was the first time a descendant of American slaves traced his genealogy back to a specific ancestor and a particular village in Africa. It opened at number 5 on the New York Times bestseller list, and by mid-November 1976, it was sitting at number 1. ABC began broadcasting the 12-hour, 8-part miniseries adaptation of the book on January 23, 1977.
After 2 years of production, we present this incredible saga in an epic motion picture. Roots, the current number one best-selling novel, is the television event of the year. From primitive Africa to the Old South.
So,
Roots sweeps across the panorama of a young America, bursting with all the dreams, all the joys, and all the hardships of a vibrant country and its people through the years of slavery. The Civil War.
Are we gonna whoop them Yankees?
Reconstruction. And the struggle to survive.
We want you, nigger.
A film spanning more than 100 years, generation to generation, continent to continent. Slavery to freedom.
Hear me, O African. The flesh of your flesh has come to freedom. We are free.
The show aired for 8 consecutive nights, and at the time, it was the biggest scripted TV event of all time, garnering over 130 million viewers, almost 60% of the American public. It was a cultural phenomenon, which shocked many TV veterans. Slavery had never been shown in such a brutal light on primetime television. Kunta Kinte was portrayed as almost a Jesus-like figure, and his beatings and maimings were more than most thought the American viewing public could take. Reports leaked that ABC executives aired the show on consecutive nights in an attempt to cut their losses, but they were wrong. It was a cultural phenomenon that touched a nerve. The series boosted book sales as well. At a little over 6 months on the shelf, 15 million hardcover copies were sold. Black Americans began making the pilgrimage to the West African Jufre village where Kunta Kinte was born. When they arrived, they were shown the ruins of the mud-bricked house he lived in. The village would eventually be named a national monument, and James Island, thought to be the place where Kunta Kinte was taken before his voyage to America, was renamed Kunta Kinte Island. The reason for Alex Haley's success was clear. He was the first Black American that had traced his family's roots to a specific person and village in Africa. The only problem was, it was a complete fabrication. More after the break.
Welcome back. So Alex Haley's book and miniseries became an international sensation, and the reason for his success was clear. He was the first Black American to have traced his family roots to a specific person and village in Africa. The only problem was, it was a complete fabrication. The first signs that something was off came a few weeks after the release of the book. A reviewer found some extreme historical errors related to the story of Kunta Kinte. Then, a few months after the miniseries became a cultural phenomenon, a curious investigative journalist named Mark Ottaway smelled something fishy in Haley's story about how he found Kunta Kinte's African village. So Mark took a trip to the Gambian village of Jufre to look into it himself. And as he pulled the thread, part of Alex Haley's hoax slowly unraveled. The reporter's investigation into the Gambian archives, British colonial records, and Lloyd's shipping register, some of the same sources used by Alex Haley, suggested that the facts underpinning the Kunta Kinte story were at best sketchy. By analyzing these records, he learned that the people of Jufideh were not the victims of the slave trade in 1767, the year Alex Haley claimed Kunta Kinte was captured, but instead were actually collaborators with whites in catching slaves farther inland. The journalist found other traces that the author's story was fabricated, but perhaps the most damning piece of evidence was the story behind the village griot. The single person provided the base on which the entire story of Kunta Kinte was built. But the griot was not a griot at all. He was basically the village scoundrel, thought to be notoriously unreliable. But that wasn't all. The griot actually knew what Alex wanted to hear before reciting the story of Kunta Kinte to Alex. You may recall that Alex first went to the capital of the Gambia and met with three men who were knowledgeable of the history of the area. In their first meeting, Alex told them in great detail the story of Kunta Kinte. Here's him admitting to that at the time.
And I met with those men in the lounge of the Little Atlantic Hotel. And I'm telling them, as I had told Dr. Vancina, every shred, every nuance of that story which I first had heard as a little boy on a Western Tennessee front porch. And these Africans listened most intently.
Those Gambian men then went out and told the griot of Jufideh the exact story Alex wanted to hear. So when Alex met the so-called griot, perhaps the most dramatic moment in the entire story, the griot was simply regurgitating Alex's story back to him. In other words, Alex was the source of the griot's ancient memory. As the investigative journalist began to press Alex Haley on these details, the reporter began to see a crack in his armor. Alex seemed prepared to concede that he may have been misled during his research in the Gambia, but that wasn't true either. Mark Ottaway uncovered a letter written from the Gambian National Archivist to Alex Haley, informing him that the griot who provided the entire basis for the story of Kunta Kinte was not a griot. The letter was dated in 1973, 3 years before the book was published. With the credibility of Alex Haley's root story beginning to crumble, he pulled a play that has become commonplace today. He accused the investigative journalist of racism, but that wasn't enough. Alex stepped it up even further, claiming that the reporter's suggestion that Roots was a fake was like, quote, saying that Anne Frank never existed or that the whole Nazi thing was a hoax. The investigative journalist challenged the author to a debate. Alex accepted, but then he backed out. It was becoming apparent to anyone that was paying attention, including the New York Times that ran an extensive story on the building controversy, that Alex Haley's root story may be a fake. But in a stunning turn, a little over a week after Mark Ottaway's explosive investigation was published, Alex Haley was given a Pulitzer Prize for the book. The establishment was apparently unconcerned that Alex's house of cards was falling. In the coming months and years, however, the fraud would become even more apparent. Alex would eventually be sued by two authors accusing him of plagiarism, including Harold Corlander, a white American novelist that specialized in the study of Afro-American cultural connections to Africa. In 1967, he wrote the novel The African and claimed that Alex had copied some 81 passages from the book. Literary experts testified during the trial as well, including one stating, quote, "The evidence of copying from The African in both the novel and the television dramatization of Roots is clear and irrefutable," end quote. The trial lasted 5 weeks, and towards the end, the judge signaled that Alex was going to lose the case. So on the eve of the verdict, instead of facing headlines that he copied, Alex settled with Corlander for a reported sum of $650,000, or roughly $2.6 million in 2020 dollars. The author of Roots also had to issue a statement, saying, quote, "Alex Haley acknowledges and regrets that various materials from The African by Harold Corlander found their way into his book Roots," end quote. But the hits kept on coming. A highly regarded genealogist researched Roots and found that Alex Haley got everything wrong in his pre-Civil War lineage. She concluded, quote, "182 pages and 39 chapters on Haley's Virginia family have no basis in fact," end quote. Another investigative journalist named Philip Noble found that Alex Haley fabricated the story that he'd stripped down to his underwear in a ship's cargo hold to get into the character of Kunta Kinte. The journalist questioned the person in charge of the ship's hold, and that person said it never happened. And he knew the author never slept in the hold because he had the key to the area and never gave it to Alex. Philip Noble also reviewed Alex Haley's collection of papers and recordings related to Roots that were released after his death, and found that in their initial meeting, the village griot did not give a detailed description of Kunta Kinte's family and descendants, as Alex Haley famously described. Never fully admitting to a fakery, Alex Haley did say to one of his detractors, quote, "I was just trying to give my people a myth to live by." Today, it's largely accepted by historian experts that Roots was not a true story. In a candid moment, respected literary critic and African-American historian Henry Louis Gates Jr., who was friends with Alex Haley, would later admit, quote, "Most of us feel it's highly unlikely that Alex actually found the village from whence his ancestors sprang. Roots is a work of the imagination rather than strict historical scholarship," end quote. This is no small admission, because each instance of brutality displayed in Roots was portrayed to the public as not only factual history, but generally not uncommon to how white people treated black slaves. The impacts of the book and miniseries were not only limited to 1977. They led to the final element needed to trigger Black Lives Matter to rise from the ashes of the Black Power movement. Roots introduced whites to the black oppression narrative and opened the doors to that narrative being a staple in America's cultural institutions. After Roots' initial broadcast, schools at all levels began using both the book and the miniseries as a history teaching tool.
Over 200 colleges gave academic credit to those who watched Roots on the air. The film is now a teaching tool at all educational levels, from kindergarten to college.
I watched it in my public elementary school as a history lesson about slavery as well, and so did others, including video streaming stars Diamond and Silk.
Okay, so I may not have paid attention in school, but this is what they would do. They would play this show called Roots.
Right.
That's Diamond.
They would play that show. And that's how you learned the history of what was going on. No, it's really the truth.
Right.
And now that kind of stuff will outrage people. But what they did not do is they did not tell us who sold black people into slavery, because really it was other Africans that had sold other Africans into slavery. Like, they didn't give you the details. They took a story and sensationalized it.
Right.
And that's how you learned it.
Mm-hmm. And then the more that they continue to play that story, Roots.
That's Silk.
Over and over and over, and more stories like that, what it did, it kept you stuck in the pain of your ancestor. You begin to believe that that's you. And that's happening to me and my people right now, even though you've never picked cotton a day in your life.
Mm-hmm.
Even though you was never a slave. Under any slave master a day in your life. And that's being implemented in the new generation, that they feel like, oh, I'm so in pain, I've been whipped with many stripes, and the white man is the one that's out to get me. That taught mentality.
Entire programs were built around this fabricated story. And Roots is still used as a history of slavery teaching tool to this day. Roots showed the way forward for the Black Power movement. To rise again, it needed to penetrate America's cultural institutions, Hollywood, the media, the music industry, literature, sports, and most importantly, the educational system. The Black Power movement needed to infiltrate these institutions and seed in the minds of white Americans the idea that blacks have been oppressed for 400 years. And it would need to continue planting that idea for at least a generation. That way, there'd be an entire crop of citizens that would know nothing else but that America's operating system was and is racist. It didn't matter if the message being planted was factually challenged like the true story of Roots, as long as it was wrong in the right direction. If delivering this message could become a structural part of America's cultural institutions, the machine would slowly pump out adults infected with the idea that America was systemically racist. So disciples of the Black Power movement embarked on this long march through the institutions. They entered Hollywood and pumped out movies like Mississippi Burning, The Color Purple, Driving Miss Daisy, Do the Right Thing, Glory, Hidden Figures, 12 Years a Slave, The Help, Get Out, The Django Unchained, 42, The Butler, Fruitvale Station, Selma, The Birth of a Nation, Black Panther, Black Klansman, and on and on and on. They used music to continue the anti-police gospel of the Black Panthers, with songs like N.W.A.'s Fuck the Police, Ice-T's Cop Killer, Public Enemies Fight the Power, and Snoop Dogg and Dr. Dre's 187 on an Undercover Cop, meaning murder law enforcement. And in education, Roots showed the way as well. Teach your youth that America is inherently racist. historians like the socialist Howard Zinn flooded university courses with his slanted, anti-American history book, A People's History of the United States. That book gave a legion of historian teachers and professors the perspective they needed to sell their students on the idea that America was an oppressor of the black and brown people. The disciples of the Black Power movement entered prestigious colleges and repackaged the oppression narrative into a serious-sounding concept called critical race theory, which favors people not based on their ability, but instead on how many oppression groups they belong to. The theory claims that black men are more oppressed than white men, gay black men are more oppressed than straight black men, and black trans Muslim women are more oppressed than them all. Activists built on this fraudulent theory to create chief diversity officers. These officers first sprouted up in colleges to make sure that the most oppressed groups received the most leeway. Then this idea spread outside the university. Today, every major corporation in America has a chief diversity officer, ensuring that opportunity is doled out based on a person's oppression ranking. Roots opened the door to all of this and showed the power of the oppression narrative. Once this idea entered our cultural institutions, it slowly corrupted the entire American experience. Like an arsonist secretly opening a home's gas line, the toxic ideology of oppression slowly filled every space of our culture. And it was just waiting for someone to strike a match to expose just how thoroughly the victim narrative had saturated America. And that match came on May 25th, 2020.
Moments ago, the chief of police in Minneapolis announced that he had fired four police officers involved in the arrest and subsequent death of a black man in police custody. George Floyd repeatedly told the officers that he could not breathe after an officer knelt on his neck, pinning him to the ground during an arrest. A bystander captured yesterday's incident on a cell phone camera.
All of the pieces of the puzzle came together on that day. And when they did, the true goal of Black Lives Matter was exposed. A goal we'll reveal in the next and final episode of our Hands Up series.
Red Pilled America is an iHeartRadio original podcast. It's produced by me, Adriana Cortez, and Patrick Carelci for Inform Ventures. Now, our entire archive of episodes is only available to our Backstage subscribers. To subscribe, visit redpilledamerica.com and click support at the top of the menu. That's redpilledamerica.com and click support at the top of the menu. Thanks for listening.